The six-figure salary curse. If you get a pay rise that pushes your income over £100,000 a year, don't celebrate too soon. Your marginal tax rate could hit 60%. We explore why this happens and what high earners can do. Chinese New Year, the year of the monkey, has got off to a good start so far. Markets bounce back this week. This is Cheer Dale Nichols, fund manager of Fidelity's China Special Situations Fund, who's flown in from Hong Kong to join us. And the search for smart beta. Everyone's looking for it, but our adventurous investor, David Stevenson, reckons he's found a good way of gaining exposure. Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's most popular weekly podcast. I'm Claire Barrett, editor of FT Money, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues Adam Palin and David Stevenson, author of our Adventurous Investor column, plus special studio guest Dale Nichols. Now, if you earn more than £100,000 a year, you risk gaining entry to an exclusive club that nobody wants to join, that of the most highly taxed people in Europe. But this is the point at which your tax-free personal allowance in Britain, worth over £10,000 a year, starts to be withdrawn. Those earning between £100,000 to £121,000 a year effectively pay a marginal tax rate of 60%, way above the UK's current top rate of 45% income tax. So why has this happened? And if you are lucky enough to earn that much, what can you do? I'm joined in the studio by Adam Palin, FT Money reporter.
Morning, Claire.
Firstly, tell us, why won't the UK government recognise that this 60% tax band even exists?
Well, it isn't a formal rate, as you alluded in the introduction. It's a nice problem to have, but it's an anomaly in the tax system that comes with each of us have this personal allowance. Back in 2010, it was decided that anyone earning £100,000, they don't need it. So for every £2 earned above £100,000, £1 of this allowance is taken away. The effect of this is that every pound earned above £100,000, you pay an extra 20p. In tax on.
Right. So if you earn £99,000 and your boss proposes a pay rise, one way of getting around this anomaly would be to insist that your pay jumps to £121,000. But assuming that doesn't work, your FT Money cover feature this week suggests some other ways that higher earners can claw back some of that lost allowance.
Exactly. And really what it's about is taking your remuneration above £99,999 in a form that isn't cash. So the most obvious way to do it for most of us is to increase your pension contributions. Now, you gain tax relief on your pension contributions at your marginal rate. The effect of this, if you're earning between £100,000 and £121,000, is that your tax relief is 60%.
Right.
Obviously, in some circumstances as well, your employer will put their saved national insurance contributions towards your pension as well. So you could actually get more than 60% effectively.
Yeah, you'd have to be pretty good at negotiating to get that. But there are other methods of salary sacrifice. Again, professionals worry that some or all of these might be culled back in the forthcoming budget. But under the current regime, what else can you do?
Well, the obvious one for parents is childcare vouchers. So until 2017, when the rules are changing, you can sacrifice some salary to gain your employer childcare vouchers that, again, effectively, so you're getting, for example, £1,000 of the vouchers for a net cost of £400. Although, as I say, things are changing in 2017, so employer schemes are going to be replaced by a government subsidy called tax-free childcare that, in fact, parents earning £100,000 or households with a salary over £100,000 won't qualify for. So giving an extra incentive for parents in that category to consider getting into the employer schemes. Now, you're not a parent, you might want to consider cycle to work schemes.
Yeah, that's one I've done.
Also very tax friendly. And then there are benefits that are taxable, such as company cars. But if you're getting a little hybrid or an electric car, that can be very advantageous.
And finally, if you don't want to give it to the tax man, could you give it to a favourite charity?
Well, in fact, tax advisors will say that it's actually the cheapest time to give money if you're within this £100,000 to £121,000 bracket, or indeed you get the most bang for your buck. So the net cost of giving, say, £1,000 to your charity, if you're in this bracket, is effectively £400 after everything's taken into account. And also there's a little ruse potentially here as well, is that gift aid donations can actually be backdated to the previous tax year, so long as you haven't filed your self-assessment return. So it is a way of navigating, say if you, I don't know, your earnings for the year go up to £101,000, you could actually give £400 and get yourself below it. And the charity will have 1,000.
Well, that was Adam Palin, FT Money reporter, and you can read his full feature with details of how to use all of those clever tactics in FT Money this weekend. Still to come on the show, is the search for smart beta still eluding you? Just over 5 years ago, Anthony Bolton, Fidelity's famed stock picker, launched a China fund in a year when the Asian nation's economy grew by almost 12% in the first quarter. The China Special Situations Fund offers exposure through a portfolio of over 100 businesses across China and proved hugely popular with investors. Fast forward to 2016, and the investment trust, now run by Australian small-cap specialist Dale Nichols, is trading on the London Stock Exchange at a discount to net asset value, depressed by China's slowing economy, currency shocks, and volatility on the Shanghai stock market. Discounts on UK-listed China funds may look very tempting for retail investors with a strong risk appetite, but amid so much uncertainty, there's much to be nervous about. But here to talk about it is none other than fund manager Dale Nichols, who's come all the way from Hong Kong to join us today.
Good morning, Claire.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Firstly, you've been saying for several months now that the Chinese stock market falls are overdone and that the crash has gone too far. Do you still think that this is the case, and what are your reasons to be cheerful?
Yeah, I think, you know, the market is down through, you know, broad macro concerns, and there's no question that that China is slowing. And it's really part of this sort of rebalancing that we're seeing from a reliance on investment and net exports to consumption. But, you know, we're still talking growth rates of, you know, maybe 5-6%, maybe below the official number, but we're still talking pretty decent growth rates. And as part of this rebalancing, you know that whatever the final growth number is, consumption is going to be growing faster. So the numbers themselves are getting bigger. But, you know, it's still a good environment for individual companies. We're talking about a very big country with, you know, under a lot of structural change. So there's real opportunities for individual companies. And again, if I couldn't find, you know, some decent growth companies in that sort of environment and that sort of growth, I'd be pretty disappointed. So it's a real opportunity because a lot of the stocks are really cheap now through those macro concerns. But the fact is, there is still real opportunity for individual companies on the ground.
But what about the high levels of debt that corporate China is carrying and the fact that the wider economy is increasingly leveraged?
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. And, you know, amongst the macro risks, the growth that we've seen in debt is the biggest concern. Now, the overall debt levels aren't that extended, but it's really the trajectory and the growth of debt. So, and it's really on the corporate side is where you've seen that. So I don't think you can make any illusions about the fact that there's going to be non-performing loan issues. And that's really the main reason that I don't own any of the Chinese banks. I think there's more bad news to come in that front. But, you know, you look at data points like retail sales and that sort of thing, the more consumption-related areas, and they continue to grow in double digits.
And the FT's written quite a lot about China's so-called shadow banking system recently, which is worrying economists and investors alike. Does it worry you?
Yeah, there clearly has been a lot of, you know, of growth in the shadow banking sector. Yeah, I think it's partly due to the rules around the banks. As you may know, there's a 75% loan to deposit ratio for the banks. So if you don't have, you know, freely flowing deposit rates and loan rates, it's hard for banks to sort of manage that and sort of grow. So it's not too much of a surprise that you've had a lot of loan growth happen, you know, off balance sheet. So when we look at bank exposures, we try to bring those off balance sheet loans back onto the balance sheets of the banks. And when we do that, you know, it's still, again, thinking from a loan deposit ratio sort of perspective and the sort of deposit backing in this, that's there in the system, that things still look fairly reasonable. The problems are, I think, are manageable, but still definitely bear watching.
How is your fund management style different to that of your predecessor, Anthony Bolton?
You know, I think there's definitely more similarities. We've talked a lot about macro right now, but for us, it's about the individual companies. So getting out on the ground, meeting with companies and finding, you know, the really interesting stories, particularly the smaller cap end where, you know, potentially the stocks aren't that well covered by the rest of the market and not that well understood and therefore mispriced. You know, in terms of differences, I guess we kind of have different backgrounds and we're probably influenced by that. As you know, Anthony focused on Europe for most of his investing career. Myself, I've been in Asia.
Okay. And he's still on the Fidelity board. Do your paths still cross?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we talk about market. He will point out every now and then what he's seeing, what he thinks is interesting.
He can't quite retire, can he?
No. And importantly, he's still a shareholder of the trust. So, you know, we've got to keep in touch and let him know what I'm doing with the trust.
And as a Westerner based in Hong Kong, how easy are you finding it to build on the ground intelligence about the Chinese companies you're owning? You've said you get good access to their management teams, for example, but do you speak Mandarin?
Not very well. So I do rely very heavily on our analyst team, both in Hong Kong and importantly on the ground in Shanghai as well. And that's where the real language skills come in.
And how do you feel when you go and see management teams? As I mean, obviously, it's clearly a different game than it than it would be from over here. But how open are they with you about their views of the future for China?
Yeah, it really depends on the company, but you know, generally fairly open. I find you know we talk about the general economy, but for me, it's really about the individual company. So understanding their opportunity set, how they see the market. But I do get the sense that the people on the ground are generally more positive and less concerned about some of the macro concerns that tend to get played out overseas.
Well, very interesting. Well, thank you very much. That was Dale Nichols, Fund Manager of Fidelity's China Special Situation Fund. Now, before our final item, a reminder that you can read this week's FT Money as part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday, or read us online, ft.com/money, and follow us on Twitter, @FTMoney. Smart beta is big business, and especially so in the world of exchange-traded funds. According to Bloomberg data, smart beta ETFs represent around 20% of the $2 trillion ETF market. But should investors be excited or scared? I'm joined in the studio by David Stevenson, FT Money's adventurous investor columnist who has tackled the topic this week. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Claire.
Now, smart beta is one of those terms that investors really get excited by, but what does it actually mean?
It's one of those awful kind of technical terms, isn't it? Beta. What does beta mean? Beta means the market. And so, in effect, what it technically means, it's just a third way between alpha. I mean, we're in the studio here and Dale's here with me, and alpha. Dale is an alpha stock picker. So he picks stocks. So that's alpha. And then beta is what the market does. And smart beta allegedly sits in the third way, the middle ground between the. So what it effectively does is it says, okay, I'm not going to individually pick every stock, which I think is what probably Dale and active stock pickers do. I'm going to pick a factor. Okay, I'm going to pick something like the dividend yield. That's an easy one to get your head around, dividend yield, or whether or not a stock is cheap, or whether or not a stock has strong momentum. And I'm going to pick a factor, and using that factor, which is easy to express in numbers, you can then basically screen through a universe of stocks, and you can end up with a shorter list. So it's a middle way. It's a cost-effective way, and it's been around for donkey's years. Quantitative investing, it's called, and pension funds have used it forever.
Now, you write in your column this week that you're increasingly worried that smart beta ETFs are being misused, particularly by institutions like those pension funds and also wealth managers. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think at the institutional level, smart beta is being sold as a way of getting extra returns, and it isn't. It's just a simple way of looking at different forms of stocks. And if you talk to a lot of pension consultants, they'll say now that smart beta is a kind of magic elixir that people use with pension funds. The stock markets haven't been very pleasing places at the moment.
No.
So smart beta is a way of grinding out an extra 1% or 2% return, but it isn't. And it shouldn't be seen as that, because if really all it's basically saying, good quants will tell you, pointy head types, they will say all this is about saying, I as an investor, for instance, I'm more cautious and I want a more cautious portfolio and I'm willing to accept lower returns but with less volatility. Or I'm more an adventurous type and I'm willing to embrace momentum, okay? In which case I might get higher returns in the market but I'm taking more risk. Mm-hmm. So these are all just conscious choices. That's what's happening in the pension funds. And what's happening in the wealth manager stakes is that I think a lot of wealth managers, for not bad reasons, because they're worried about cost, are replacing active stock pickers who aren't very active, okay? Because not all active stock pickers are active. And they're replacing them with smart beta because they think it's cheaper and more cost effective. And they're sticking them in our portfolios. And the problem is that I probably think that the vast majority of wealth advisors have absolutely no idea how those smart beta ideas originated, where they come from. They sound like a quick, handy thing. So it's like, I've got a client who's a bit defensive and they're a bit worried about, you know, they're maybe in their late 40s and they're worried the stock market's a volatile place. I'll stick it in low volatility smart beta. And what they're thinking there is what low volatility beta means is the stocks probably don't bounce around as much as the main index. So our client would be happy. Well, yeah, the client may be happy, but I don't think, A, the client understands anything about the strategy. I'm not sure the wealth advisor knows anything about the strategy. And B, there's a downside. And the downside is if you look at a lot of these low vol strategies, for instance, they're chock-a-block full of defensive utility stocks. They work for some periods of time, and then they don't work for some periods of time. So each of these flavors, and I think the good way of looking at smart beta, it's a bit like cookery, subject close to my heart. Smart beta is all the ingredients that you have about investing in complicated terminology. And the clever bit is about putting the ingredients all together.
In a blend.
In a blend. Mm. And that's the point. So the way about, there are ways to survive in the market, and you need to think like a cook does.
Well, you can read more in David Stevenson's Adventurous Investor column this week about ways that he thinks you could gain exposure to smart beta. Thanks very much there. And thank you to our resident alpha males in this studio for taking part in today's podcast. We'd love to know what you think about investing in China, the tax traps affecting higher earners, or money matters more generally. You can get in touch via email, our address, money@ft.com, or you can tweet us at FTMoney. And you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else will feature in this weekend's issue. Former Money editor Jonathan Ely tells us what's puzzling him about millennials and their money. And as usual, we have the latest share tips and director's deals from the Investors Chronicle. The Money Show is produced and edited in London by Naomi Rovnik. We will be back next week, but for now it's goodbye from me and our studio guests. Goodbye.